Session number 27053.
Mr. Dry, reel 15. Now, we're talking about your time when you'd gone to the 2nd 7th Queen's Regiment, C Company, and you'd pulled back to Maserata.
Yeah.
Had a racehorse meeting. Anything else while you were there?
Well, we'd done a few... we'd done training. I remember we had to do some night work, a lot of night patrolling work.
Now, tell me about what sort of training you did for that.
Well, it was just like we were detailed to do a normal patrol, but they had sent out another company and so forth to be the enemy, and we had to sort of get through mainly. They would tell us, give us roughly a map to read and one thing another, and we had to get through without being caught and so forth, and then sometimes we acted as the enemy. So we done a lot of patrol work, but another thing we done, our platoon. I remember the mortar platoon were doing some practice firing once, and they were dropping the shells into in their bombs into an area, mostly vineyards and one thing another. And there was a farm, and what they'd done, they put men out with the radio. We had what they call 38 sets. They were little fellas with a better mild range. And we had to, like, keep in touch on this range. No one could go in that area. Well, they'd apparently decided that they were going to... some of them were coming back through the area. So they'd put the signal out to... all the wireless, and well, there was a little Italian girl in this farm where I was, in the yard, and I'm, you know, young man, chat to this girl in silly Italian, and the firing, you know, someone come over and said, are they clear? And I said, all's clear, and apparently I hadn't heard the signal that this group were coming through the firing area, the target area. And so they dropped some mortar bombs in, and the next thing, swearing and cussing up the drive, come these lads. Fortunately, they weren't right in the middle of them, but their mortars had dropped fairly close to them, and I'd given the signal all clear, and they realised that I should have stopped, you know, stopped the firing. But I said, well, I didn't. I'd done what I was told and that, but they were cussing and swearing about me. But it was because I was chatting this little Italian girl up, you see, instead of paying attention. So that could have been a disaster for me.
What did you think of these 38 wirelesses? I mean,
they're pretty useless, mine, but...
why are they?
They hadn't got any range. And if you had a building or anything like that obstructing, you lost the signal.
What were they like to carry?
Oh, easy. They were only a small box. No, you didn't carry them on your back, carry them on your chest. And you had a throat mic, coming around a throat mic, and
who would have them?
All platoons had them. You'd have
just one per platoon.
No, I think you had about three to a platoon. The companies had the 18 sets, the big boys that the boys had to carry on the back. Dangerous job because they had a big pack, and they had a long area, and the Germans would be that. They'd pick them. When you're trained to be a sniper, this is the sort of target you look for. Anyone carrying a big pack with an aerial coming from it, that's a target. And also, there are other features you look for among troops.
I just want to check that you didn't have a Bren gun carrier, so you weren't in a Bren gun carrier.
Oh, no, by this time I lost the Brens that's when right. I left in a rifle company now, that's C
just,
company.
Just confirming then.
Yeah, I'm back.
You were saying about other sniper targets. What other things?
Well,
because you'd done a bit of sniping.
Yeah.
What were sniper targets?
Well, what they tell you that if you, they tell you like about the value of a soldier. A private soldier is X amount of money. It costs the government to recruit him, train him, feed him, ship him out, and all this sort of thing is X amount of money. But an officer is much more value or a sergeant than that. So. If you can, you look for an officer. Now, the German army made the foolish error, same as the British. Very often they'd go out in their peaked cap and they'd have a bit of coloured material around the neck as a neckerchief or whatever around the neck. and probably a revolver hung at their side, and that a German sniper, that's what he'd look for. Well, we had looked for, if you saw a small patrol coming, like creeping along, and I did once, that I haven't told you about, that we did see a patrol. No, I've not come to that yet, no. And the officer was leading, and the officer had distinct silver braid on his neck, and he was the officer, but I wasn't sniping them. We had a Bren gun, and I was in a Bren gun. But that's the sort, you look for the senior or the leader of a unit, and a senior ranks, that's what you're looking for. Of course, chaps carrying a radio, you'll put that out of action, you've done some damage to them. That's what you're looking at mainly. Valuable targets, like, that would be the most harmful to be able to get rid of.
Now, any other training or anything else happened while you were at Maserata?
Not really. Yes, we did. Yes, yes. I was trained on Tommy guns. They'd brought a lot of Tommy guns in. They weren't the drum type. They were utility types. They had a front grip, but they had 11 magazine of 11 straight magazine for them. Still the same bullet though, 5mm, half inch, wasn't it? And they were a cheap version of the Tommy gun, and they
not the Sten.
Tommy guns. Tommy guns. I never handled a Sten gun in my life. They took us. It was rather nice. There's a big quarry place near Maserata, and what they'd done, they had chaps in slit trenches, and an NCO would take you through, follow you through. He'd tell you to go down this path. And there'd be someone in a slit trench, and he had a rope to a dummy, like a straw-filled sack or things, and suddenly this would swing out on your path or pull out on you, and you had to give it a burst as quick as you could as you went through it. Or you'd find a dummy somewhere would spring up, but chaps were pulling it by ropes, well, in the safety of slit trenches. And we'd done several goes of this, and I liked the Tommy gun, but a lot of chaps didn't like them.
Now, why did you like it, and why didn't they like it?
I don't know why they didn't. They thought they had a bigger range, of course, because you knew if you're going to use a Tommy gun, you're going to be in close quarter fighting, because they hadn't got much of a range. I mean, you're using them at 20 yards maximum, really, although you do open up on them further, but you're going to be in close quarter if you're going to use a Tommy gun. But I liked them. And I chose
What did you like about it?
It was nice to handle. It was a lovely gun to handle. I just liked it, and I suppose I'd seen, you know, I knew it was an automatic thing as well, although you can fire it on single shot, but you can give a burst of that. And I felt much more confident with a Tommy gun than I would with a rifle, and I've never used a bayonet into a. Only practice. I've never had to stab a man with a bayonet, and I don't know anyone that has. But they did, of course, at times. But we never got that. Either the Germans threw their hands up, or you shot them, one or the other. But you know, instead of using a bayonet. But although you fix bayonets when you go into the attack, they say prepare to advance, fix bayonet. But. Yes, I had the Tommy gun, and I liked that. I went on several. I volunteered or asked if I could go on the Tommy gun course several times, and I could handle one. I was pretty good at it. I didn't make much blunders. So they said, when we went back in the line, I asked if I could carry a Tommy gun, and they said yes. And I was carrying, as the last weapon I carried in action was a Tommy gun. And
It is a Thompson machine gun,
yeah.
But it's adapted from what you're saying.
It's a cheap version. The proper Tommy gun, I have fired them too, mine. They had a front grip and a rear grip, and they had up the front of the barrel a sort of bulbous thing with slits on the top. And that was what happens when the gas went up the barrel. Some of the gas following the bullet shot upwards, and it formed like a jet, and it kept the barrel level. Whereas if there's none of that, the barrel tends to come back on you. So you have to have the knack of holding it to stop it jerking up in the air. So there was that on it. There wasn't much other difference, but and it just had a little leaf sight, because you don't take sight with a Tommy gun. You don't need a sight.
Now, so what happened next, and how long were you probably back at Maserati?
Well, as I say, it must have been, we were back there, well, probably 3 weeks. 3 weeks must have been.
So into October?
We're into October. We're well into October, yeah. Well into October now, I think. We're into October.
What happened next?
Well, then they tell them we're moving. Now, there's been, unfortunately, there's another thing that the war, the diaries and that don't write too much about. There was a lot of desertion going on.
Tell me about that. Now, what were you aware of?
Well, I knew that there's blokes, what they call doing a runner nowadays. And our attitude to them was, well, mine was, anyhow, these chaps had been in the North Africa. They'd fought through there right up Sicily, Italy. And then we knew the war was coming to an end because we were getting news bulletins how the Russians were sweeping west from on the Russian front. And we knew that the Allies had gone up. They'd been Arnhem. They were well up into Holland. They hadn't yet, of course, got across the Rhine, but we knew they were going to, obviously. They'd taken all Normandy. We knew the war was coming to an end. So these lads weren't, I can understand them. They aren't going to get killed at the last knock-ins. So some of them, I think the penalty was 6 months in jail and loss of certain other things, I don't know what. But I had a tattoo on my arm, death before dishonour. That would have been a terrible thing to go before a court-martial, try with doing a runner, wouldn't it? And having three brothers in the army, one a glider pilot, one in the 1st Special Air Service Regiment, and one in the artillery, how could I come and live among them again if I'd done a runner? But I never entered my head. This is true and very honest. It would have been harder for me to run away than to go forward, I tell you. I couldn't have done it.
So what level of desertions were we talking about?
Well, this is it. I'm going to tell you that while we were there at Maserata, we had a guard room. It was downstairs to this guard room. And we had a whole batch of prisoners come. They weren't only ours. They came into this barracks. And they had arrived one day. And I was on guard duty. And I was only a Bakshi private. And we were told that we'd got to feed our men at a meal. It was in the evening. Take down the Dixies with food for them. Now, these new arrivals had been given rations for the day to last them the rest of the day. So down we go to feed our men. So we're feeding them, and these chaps that had just arrived, a whole group of them, ruffians by the look of it, a lot of them, all been found like in pubs and that all over Italy by the SBI, you know, and the field police and so forth. They had picked them up, and they sort of marshalled them in this barracks. They were going back, a lot of them were, for sentence, for court-martial. But they'd brought them into this barracks at Maserata, because by this, it's a fair distance from the line, Maserata. Bear in mind that the fighting's going on north of Forli. So down we go to feed them. When we fed them, they said, what about ours then? So we said, well, we understand. You've had your rations for today. None of this is for you. And there was all this effing and blinding and swearing. So I said to the other boy, a young chap called Knight, friend of mine, I said, go and get the provost sergeant. He's the sergeant in charge of your police, the regimental police. Now, this is exactly what happened. He come down, he said, what's the matter? I said, these chaps reckon that they want some grub, and they'd eaten it. You see, they'd eaten their rations, and there was no more rations that day, been issued. So he said, what's the matter? And they're all swearing and milling around him. And this provost sergeant, probably an ex-policeman, I don't know his background, he said to them, look here, you lot. There's plenty of grub up the line if you've got the guts to go up and get it, you yellow bastards. That was his very words. And there was hush. None of them moved to him or anything. And that was he had settled the issue. They got no grub, and out we come. Well, that was the first time I'd come across deserters. Well, now, a few nights later, they got us in a cinema. It was a Sunday afternoon, and they got us in a big cinema in Maserata. At each door, there was regimental police and so forth. Our CO and the RSM were up on the stage, and The CO started talking. Was all the battalion were in the cinema. They'd marshalled us in. And they said that, once again, the brigadier had saw fit to take us into the line to show the German what they were up against and to help conclude this terrible war and bring it, finalise it, and soon we'd be home with our loved ones. And the lads started shouting and shuffling. Some of the lads did in there. And the RSM bawled out to them, "You better stop this noise immediately or else, see?" So anyhow, the CO went on to say, he said, "Unfortunately, because of a number of men that have gone absent," he says, "you're going to have to sign the warning order when you leave the cinema." And there was a book on the doors with regimental police. He says, "Now, if you desert now after you've signed the warning order, you'll be charged with desertion in the face of the enemy." Prior to that, if we'd have done a runner while we were swanning around in Maserata, it would have been absence without leave. But we signed this warning order. It's the only time I've ever done it. But it was a measure they were taking because there were so many deserting. Well, we all shoveled out the door, and as we went out, we each had to sign, and with our regimental number, on this book. And out we went. And that's where we were on the go. So that night, they told us, it was about midnight, the lorries came into the yard of the barracks, and we all had to put our quit up, and the corporal called the roll call. And there were several blanks. And I was one of them. He said, "Go in and see where they are, like, go in, Dre, and have a look in the barrack room." I went in, and there was heaps of equipment with rifles and steel helmets and that laid on the floor, and no men. They'd done a bunk. And there must have been, in my company, at least three, but in the battalion, God knows how many there was. So we just reported it, that there was no one in there, and up the line we went, on the lorries, and up we went. And they took us up to some positions just south of the town of Faenza.
Faenza?
Faenza, spelled F-A-E-N-Z-A.
And this is late October or early November?
This is November now, yeah. Early November, I suppose we were going up. And we were in a farm again there, fortified. And in front of us was the River Lamoni, not a huge river, the Lamoni. And we were right opposite the town. And we guarded, and the road ran up beside this farm, straight up into the town of Faenza. We had a roadblock across up the top there. I remember there was a single block garage, and they'd knocked some blocks out, and there was a loopholes, and that's where we used to have to go up at night and stand there, or get in there with our rifles poked through, just in case the Germans came over. But they had no intentions of doing that. Their intentions were stop us getting over the river. Well, then they decided in early December they were going to take the town. So the CO called O Group, and I had this young lieutenant. Don't ask me his name, I've forgotten his name. We had to go down through a wadi and to another farm where the CO was, and it was all dirt. And as we went down in the farmyard, a damn mortar burst. And I sort of went to duck, and I remember I went up to my hips almost in a midden, a liquid manure, this farm. I stank like a polecat when we crept into this farmhouse, and it was a dull light, and all the officers of the battalion were gathered in there, and the CO, and he started telling them. I'm in the background, of course. I've gone as a bodyguard for this officer, you see, with my Tommy gun, gone with him, like, to make sure he got to the farm.
He was a runner, or just...
Yeah, sort of a runner with him. And the CO said, "We're going to take Faenza." And he had an aerial photograph there, and he was pointing out, when we take it, A Company will be there, C Company will be there, and all the companies where we were going to take the town and fortify it. This is December the 7th. Well, up we went. They said, "We're moving the next morning." It was early in the morning we moved, and we went west of the town, down a road, with keeping the Lamoni on our right, and then we went over a very bad bridge. There wasn't a proper bailey. We got across.
This is the Lamone. How do you spell that river?
Lamone, the Lamone.
All one word?
Yeah, Lamone.
Now, are you approaching Faenza? I'm not sure.
No, we're going to... Look, no.
We're in Faenza.
No, we were this side. The river was between us and the town. And we were looking straight at it. But now this morning we left before light and we went west of it. So the river was on our right-hand side. And down we went about, must be a couple of miles. Well, in the evening, we didn't know it, though there'd been a heavy bombardment and we had to go down against their river bank and fire all sorts of things into Lamone, into Faenza. What they call a Chinese attack. So the Germans thought we were coming across the river or going to try and get across. And we fired all sorts of stuff, but it was just to divert his attention. What had happened, I think it was the 4th Division. I think it was the 4th, had crossed the river just about 2 miles west of Faenza, got across the Lamone. And then they'd instantly turned right. So they're then heading towards Faenza with the river on the right. But they didn't go far, they dug in. Now, we went up, we went over this bridge affair that they'd got across. There was no tanks had got across at that stage. At least I don't think there might have been one or two. Yes, there was. One or two tanks had got across somewhere. And we went up at first light. We went in on the 7th of December. So we passed through these lads. I don't know who they were. I can't think. I think they were Green Howards.
So you'd done the Chinese attack first.
Yes.
And now
while this 4th Division had gone across the river, then we went over through their lines. And now there was the river. We were heading towards Faenza again. You understand? We'd gone left over the river and we're going right and back to Faenza. Now there was the river on our right. There was this orchard. 300 or 400 yards wide, this strip of land going right up to Faenza. Then there was a road running parallel on our left side with some high ground on the left above that. And the 2nd, 5th battalion was supposed to be tacking on our left, going towards Faenza. And we went through this orchard and first of all we got into a minefield and I told this officer, I said, we're in mines. Oh, he said, we keep going. Because the Germans put a board up, you know, mine in. They actually tell you where the minefield is. And it was 9 o'clock in the morning, I remember. I remember it. It was quite light and we got up there. And he started shooting us bad. He knew we were coming and down come the artillery and mortars. We hadn't hit any infantry, but the barrage was terrible trying to... The big pieces of trees were flying off and goodness knows what.
Were you actually in this minefield as well?
We went through that. We got through this minefield. It was probably anti-tank tellers. And we got up and we come into an opening. And there was a path running across from the river to a farm on our left. And the officer was leading us. An officer leading us, the lads were all scattered, and I remember a mortar dropped and killed both their signallers. They were carrying an 18 set with us, and I was on his right hand side and I saw a wire move and I shouted at him, tripwire. Well, of course, it's all in a seconds, and as I looked at the foot of a peach tree, there was an S mine had been tied there, strapped there, and it was being triggered by this tripwire. See, an S mine, normally, you tread on it, it jumps about 3-4 feet in the air and explodes and throws out all its ghastly shrapnel or ball bearings. Well, this one was tied to the foot of the tree and it exploded. There was this terrible flash and bang. I don't know what. I sort of gathered my senses and I look around. And the officers laid there screaming for stretcher bearers. And I lay there and I realised I'd been hit in the leg somewhere, but I don't know, it didn't hurt me, although it smashed the bone of my ankle, but it didn't hurt. It numbs you, see, and then I suppose the explosion had numbed my brain a bit too. Then this lad Knight, I'm telling you about, that I've been friendly with, he come running up and I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "Oh, Mr. So-and-so," I think he was called Ferris. He said, "He's been hit." I said, "You get the hell out of here," because I was afraid another mine would go up, you see. But at all events, the stretcher bearers came up. They were following, like they're only about 100 yards behind carrying and the stretchers, and they came up. And this officer hadn't been hit at all. He didn't know if he was hit or not, you see. And they carried me up this path. There was three of us wounded. There was a corporal been hit in the head, one killed, and two wounded, or three wounded, myself, two others wounded. And they carried us wounded chaps up to the farm and took us in, and they laid me on a settee, and terrible shell fire going on, rattling this farm. And I remember our company commander had come up, and this officer was there getting a bit panicky, and I remember him saying to this officer, "Archie, pull your bloody self together, man, you'll have your men panicking in a minute." And anyhow, Archie come to me and said, "You hit, Dre?" I said, "Yes, sir." "Where are you hit?" He said, "Oh, I am not hit." I said, "I thought I heard you shout for stretcher bearers." He said, "I was, for you lads. But I think he thought he might have been hit himself, but he gave me a cigarette, at all events." And they were all sheltering now, and they couldn't do anything, couldn't get us out. And the shell fire was too bad. And anyhow, it eased off, and they brought a jeep up this road on our left with a Red Cross flying on the front, a chap with and they had two stretchers up on it. And they put me and this corporal, the bit hit in the head, on the stretchers. And they turned the thing in the farmyard and drove back this road. And believe it or not, on the right-hand ditch as we drove down, the Germans were there just looking up at us. There was Germans in their slit trenches down the side of this road. And what had happened, we had come up through the narrow bit between the river and the road, but the 2nd, 5th hadn't made an advance on our right, the other side of the road. So the Germans still held it, and they didn't fire at us. And that's why I remember the tanks, because the next thing we passed was a Sherman tank blazing and crackling on the side of the road further back. And they took us into a church. It wasn't a steepled church, but it was a church. An insteteria was there. And I remember they took us in the door, and a wretched shell burst right in the yard. And I'm not far in the doorway. And I remember saying to some of these the medical corps chaps were there, "For God's sake, put us inside a little bit further." And they moved my stretcher in. And there was a chappie came in, and he said, "We can't evacuate it because they've got to get the Bailey Bridge built." So, but about lunchtime, the things had quietened down, the shell fires and that. And he said, this chap came aboard, an ambulance came in, and he came aboard, and they put us in the ambulance. There was four of us. There was two officers, and there was a boy from the Irish Horse, a tank chappie. I think he might have been from the tank that was hit. And myself, four of us in this ambulance. And he said, "I'll have you over the river soon. We'll soon be away." And he had a bit of American accent. And he gave us cigarettes, and he talked and joked with us while we waited. Then he said they must have given him the signal that they could roll. And he took us down the road a little way, and then we heard him. He said, "Here we go." And we went over we heard the rumble of the Bailey underneath of us. And away we went. And he said, "There, we're clear now." And he took us back to near Forley. We went well back.
What sort of a vehicle was that?
In an ambulance. Now, I discovered afterwards, I was talking to someone about it, and you said, this chap, he had a battle dress on with no insignia, no badges or anything. And do you know, he was an American conscientious objector who was driving ambulances. He was really a civvy. But it just shows that all these conscientious objectors are not cowards or anything. He was up there driving us wounded back under shell fire, and he was the most pleasant man, and he took us back. And when we were well out of the line, like going heading for Forley, he said to us, "You're laughing, and you're going to be in hospital for Christmas." And I got into an advanced field hospital.